Hey,
you're listening to Avid Research.
Avid Research.
Avid Research.
An Australian STEM podcast.
Where we answer the questions you never quite got around to asking.
Welcome back to the show, team. My name's Amelia, and today we have a very cool guest on the show. We have Associate Professor Dr. Neil. Welcome to the show, Dr. Neil.
Hi, no, thanks very much for inviting me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Starting with possibly a complicated question, but what is your job?
So I am an endocrinologist. So I practice clinical endocrinology, predominantly in diabetes. I'm the Director of Clinical Services at the Baker Institute in Melbourne, and we do clinical work and clinical research here.
That sounds like a lot of things.
Yeah, it's busy. Yes, it is busy.
Can you start with giving us a bit of an overview as to what an endocrinologist actually does?
So endocrinology is the study of, I guess, hormones, and there's many hormonal systems, and the thyroid, the pituitary, the adrenal glands, etc. But the pancreas, of course, is one of the key endocrine organs, and so diabetes is the most common of these conditions. And so we have type 1, type 2 diabetes, and that's by far the mainstay of what an endocrinologist does, and certainly my strongest interest in this field. So I see people with chronic illness with diabetes, really. That's what I do most of the time.
So both seeing them as patients and, I guess, working with them to do research and understand things better?
Exactly right. So we've got a large clinical service here at the Baker, and we see a lot of patients, and we also have a lot of clinical trial work in various areas of interest as well.
Again, a lot of things happening.
Yep.
For people who like have heard of diabetes but haven't like yet had it hit too close to home, are you able to give us a bit of a description? What's the difference between type 1, type 2?
Yeah, sure. There's a few different types, but type 1, type 2, and gestational would be the most common type. So type 2 diabetes is common, and it is associated with being a little bit overweight in the older age group, so overweight and obesity. And we sort of talk about an epidemic of diabetes associated with westernization and obesity. And it's around the world. It's an increasing issue, of course. So we have a lot of type 2 diabetes. That's about 90 to 95% of the diabetes. And type 1 diabetes is quite different. Type 1 diabetes is a condition that affects the pancreas gland directly. And what it does is it kills off all the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. So what it means is that you have no insulin at all. And this often comes on in young children, teenagers, or young adults, out of the blue. And it's nothing to do with weight or diet. It just happens. And it's an autoimmune type condition in which the immune system attacks your own pancreas and sort of kills it off. Now, the trouble is that without insulin, you can't live. And back more than 100 years ago, this was the death sentence. People would just die of this condition. But since we discovered insulin, we now have a treatment, which is insulin injections for those people with type 1 diabetes, which is lifelong injections with insulin. So a very different condition to type 2, which is more about resistance to insulin and being overweight, where you still produce insulin, but not enough. And gestational diabetes is a type of diabetes that is very common in pregnancy and usually resolves, but puts you at risk of type 2 diabetes going forward.
And then there's presumably other things that can happen to the pancreas.
Absolutely correct. So there's other types of diabetes. For example, you can get what we call pancreatitis, which is rare, but it can, for various reasons, you get inflammation in the pancreas due to gallstones or other conditions, which destroys the pancreas and you have diabetes as a result. And there's other genetic types of diabetes which are nothing to do with any of this. They're much less common, but we see single genetic mutations that cause diabetes as well. So there's a range of things.
If I can ask you a slightly rogue question, can any being with a pancreas get diabetes? Like as in dogs, cats, what are they called? Dolphins?
Yes. So we're seeing and increase rates of diabetes now. I mean, particularly domesticated animals. I think there's some dog species that have a big problem with being well fed, and obesity is not just a human issue in some of these species. So absolutely correct. We do see, and there's probably genetic issues in some of these species as well. So absolutely correct. We do see diabetes in other species.
Fascinating. I cannot imagine trying to treat an animal's diabetes with like insulin injections. That would be, it's hard enough to do.
Oh, it happens.
What is it about the like insulin pancreas system that you find particularly interesting?
I think, I particularly like the chronic disease management aspect of managing people with diabetes. It's a condition where it doesn't go away, and patients, I guess you need to get to know your patients very, very well over many, many years, and that's an aspect of medical management that I like. But it's also, both type 2 and type 1 are fascinating because there's new therapies which are changing everything. And so, you know, in type 1 diabetes, one of our interests is the artificial pancreas device, where which is really interesting research, where we can not cure it, but certainly manage our type 1s much more effectively. And in type 2, there's a whole lot of new therapies that are reducing glucose, reducing obesity, and there's a whole new wave of treatment. So it's a really happening area of research and progress, I think.
Do you know much about how they worked out, like how they discovered insulin?
Yeah, quite a lot, actually. So Banting and Best were the people who won the Nobel Prize for discovering insulin. It's just over 100 years ago, so we celebrated that milestone recently. And they worked in a little laboratory with dogs, and basically they found that if they tied off the ducts of the pancreas in the dog, there would be only a few surviving cells, and those cells were producing something that lowered glucose. And they purified that, and they found this product they called Islatin. And a year later, there was a young man in a hospital at the right place at the right time who came in with type 1 diabetes, and he was dying. And so they said, look, we might just have something to save your life. So they purified this protein from an animal, and they injected this kid, and he initially had a bit of an allergic reaction. They went back to the lab and purified it a bit more, and he survived. And soon after that, there was a famous governor in the States whose daughter developed type 1 diabetes, and he was a powerful man, and he heard about this, and so he managed to get her treated as well. And then it became a whole, he managed to get the interest of various companies to produce this product from animal products, and it was, so it was available to a large number of people. So it's a fascinating, it's one of the most important medical discoveries of all time, and really tremendously. And, back in the 1920s or before that, it was a death sentence to have type 1. People would just come in and die. There was no treatment, nothing you could do for these people. So, type 1 diabetes is a very nasty, life-threatening illness, but we've come such a long way in 100 years now to the point where we can really manage people very effectively.
And we're developing new insulins, I assume the insulin itself isn't new, it's the stuff around it that makes it faster or slower.
That's right. So there's insulin has been played with for a long time. So they used to, I'm old enough to remember we had animal insulin in the outpatient clinics, beef and pork insulin. Then they discovered how to produce human insulin, and so it became the first product reproduced by recombinant DNA technology using bacteria. And so human insulin was sort of mass produced for the first time ever. And so I remember the first patients getting human insulin. And then we fiddled with that molecule to make it a bit faster, because when you inject it under the skin, it's not quite as fast as the insulin the body makes. And so we make it a bit quicker. But we also need slow-acting insulins to last all night. And so there's been lots of fiddling with the insulin molecule to make it faster and slower, to the point now where we may even have once weekly injections of insulin, which might be an interesting treatment for some people as well. So the whole range of insulins in the variety of how quickly and slowly they work. But insulin's still insulin. It's still the same product.
How do they produce it in a factory?
So yeah, that's a good question. Mainly with what they do is they genetically alter bacteria. So, I mean, bacteria normally produce proteins and they can insert the genetic code into them, and so they mass produce it. And they obviously have to purify it and do all sorts of things, but it is mass produced now. Having said that, there could be shortages in some parts of the world, some countries as well with insulin, but it certainly is mass produced by many companies around the world now pretty successfully.
That's amazing that you can get bacteria to produce like a human compatible thing. That's just...
It's impressive, isn't it?
Yeah, useful bacteria. That's
yeah,
awesome.
Exactly.
Can you tell us a little bit about the artificial pancreas concept?
So we have had insulin pumps have been around for a little while. They're little devices that contain rapid-acting insulin, and you basically have a little device and a tube that comes out, and you put the tube into your skin, usually in the stomach, and it infuses insulin 24 hours a day at different rates. And so we used to think that was preferable to having injections, because people with type 1 diabetes otherwise need 4 injections, maybe more a day, which is difficult. And it's not perfect, because when you do an injection, you're only doing it every 6-8 hours, and the doses, you can't really fine-tune the doses that much. The pumps are much more fine-tuned. You can take, instead of taking 2 or 3 units, you could take 2.2 units or 2.8, you know what I mean? You can vary them much more. So we liked insulin pumps. Now, on top of that, we realized that if you measure sugar frequently, and we traditionally were doing finger prick testing with measuring sugars, there are now devices where you can measure the sugar every single minute of the day, 24 hours a day. And if you have that sort of information and marry it up with these pumps, you could vary the pump according to what the sugar is doing and what the sugar is forecast to do. So we call these systems automated insulin delivery systems or artificial pancreas. So up until now, there's about 3 commercial artificial pancreas or automated insulin delivery systems available. Having said that, there's still what we call hybrid. They still require input from the patient. So you still have to tell these devices when you're eating and what you're eating. You've got to sort of announce or count your carbohydrates to tell it. So what we are doing, we're doing one of the first ever studies that doesn't require that. So in other words, we think we've got an algorithm which is based on a mobile phone that's sensitive enough to detect when your blood sugar goes up and down and react really quickly to it to increase or decrease. So we are in the middle of a study looking at whether that's feasible or safe thing to do with this algorithm. So the patients can literally hook themselves up to a pump and this continuous glucose monitor device, and they can do whatever they like and not even think about their diabetes all day. Now, that's a game changer for people with type 1 diabetes, because people with type 1 diabetes have to make more than 100 decisions every single day about what they're eating, when they're exercising, what their sugar's doing, how many carbs, what insulin dose to take. And we think we can remove that burden from these people.
That sounds very exciting.
It is. So it's been a great study. You know, it's really, as I say, we're in the middle of it, but so far people love it. We're really impressed with it, and we hope to make this something that people will be able to use, you know, hopefully soon.
It sounds like a really interesting space to be in, moving from like purely looking at medicine as like you put medicine in and you try and improve the medicine, to integrating technology and moving into a sort of a tech point where the technology is shaping how we can improve patients' lives. Like, that's
absolutely
a really interesting space to change into. Mm.
Absolutely no question. You know, the artificial pancreas requires a lot of algorithm intelligence and probably, you know, artificial AI type work as well. So I think these systems are going to get better and better. And I think you're right. We're going to see more and more medicine with AI associated technology.
How have you found like working with technology coming from a medicine background?
Very challenging, because we don't know any of this stuff as doctors. We we resist it. We don't like people going online and Googling illnesses and all sorts of things. But I think, you know, the more I've worked with it, the more I've realized the potential of it. And really what I think I've seen lately is that these gadgets, I'm afraid to say, they do a better job than we do. They do a better job than the patients can do. They're really smart. And it's reaching that point where I think we can trust them, and they're very effective therapies. It's a hard thing for doctors to let go of, though, because automated system doing the job that we used to do, it's a challenge for us, I think, in many ways.
I like to think, like, I don't think your job's going away anytime soon.
No, it's not going away. It's going to change.
Going to change. And hopefully it means you can support your patients with, like, higher level problems as well, if the base stuff is dealt with. Like,
yes, I think so.
What did it take you seeing these systems doing for you to have faith in them?
Oh, look, I think I've been on board with the pumps for a long time because, you know, the patients on injections, some of them are doing badly, really badly. And you sort of feel like you've got to try something new because they're really struggling and suffering and having highs and lows. And, you know, you think, and you put them on a pump and all of a sudden things smooth out and they think, oh, this is much more manageable. And then you put them on a system like this and really their lives change. They say, wow, this is just, I can wake up every morning and I can see my sugar is fine. And I used to worry about having hypos during the night and not waking up and all this. And all that's gone away. All this stress and worry of the sort of erratic sugars of type 1 seem to sort of melt away a little bit with this. And it really does change. It's hard work, type 1. It's really difficult managing this day to day, hour to hour, minute to minute. And so, you know, these systems make a big difference.
So we've talked a lot about type 1 and there's stuff happening. It's awesome. What are some of the developments that are happening for type 2?
So type 2 is a really busy area because, you know, we used to, going back 20 years, we used to have a couple of tablets and insulin injections. That was about it. We now have a huge number of medications for type 2 diabetes, which have emerged in the last 10 or 15 years, tablets and injections. And we know these not only are just good at lowering sugar levels, but they also have secondary benefits on some of the really nasty outcomes of type 2. For example, heart disease and kidney disease. So we have these tablets that are very effective now and have a beneficial side effect on lowering heart and kidney outcomes as well. And we now have these new injections, which everyone's heard about, Ozempic, I suppose, and all the celebrities using it. But that really came out of some very effective medications that were developed some years back. And they've just progressed to the point where we can use them once a week, and they're very effective therapies.
So it's not just like helping sugars, but it's also helping all the complications and stuff. That's awesome.
Correct. And of course, this leaks over into the world of obesity where people without diabetes are starting to use some of these agents very effectively, in fact, so effectively, there's a bit of a worldwide shortage of some of these drugs because a lot of people want to use them for weight loss.
And there is no shortage of people who want to lose weight.
There's no shortage. You're right.
Yeah. So as part of your role, you don't just see patients, but you also are involved in research?
Correct.
What does it take as someone who's interested to be involved with research? Like, what does it involve?
You mean as in terms of participants or?
Oh, sorry, as participants, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, we have a number of different studies going, and of course, on our website's full of these types of studies. But I think if you're interested, it's a matter of, I guess, maybe looking at these websites to see if you have a study that might be appropriate for you. It depends if you've got type 1, type 2, obesity. We have a whole range of these types of studies. But, or you can, of course, discuss it with your GP or your clinician, because there's always a lot of trials around in various parts of the country that might be appropriate for you. But you know, we'd encourage people to look at our website and get involved if they're interested.
Do you have any studies coming up that you can talk about and are excited about?
Yeah, I think one of the most important studies that we're doing going forward in the next few months is a large Indigenous national trial. So we have a strong interest in Indigenous diabetes. So Indigenous health, of course, is is one of these issues in chronic disease in Indigenous people is have a very high burden of chronic illness and a shortened life expectancy associated with that. And diabetes is one of those key conditions which they're very prone to. And we've done a lot of work in remote communities and regional remote Aboriginal communities over the years. And we really see a very malignant type of type 2 diabetes in these in this group, a little bit like the Pacific Islanders and some of the other populations, the American Pima Indian group, some of the Middle Eastern population. So it is a lot of strong genetics in this, of course, but you know the outcomes really, the complication rates are extreme and the type of diabetes is pretty extreme. So we're looking at new therapies in that population. We're about to do a large national trial in about 10 regional and remote communities around the country, looking at a new model of care for this type of diabetes. So we think that's really, really important because we really would like to make a difference in the outcomes of this population.
Are you able to talk at all to what I guess is causing that the extreme problems?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think there's in the background, of course, there's westernization, if you like, of all populations. And we're seeing obesity and diabetes rates everywhere around the world in every country increase. And basically what we've done, I guess, is we've produced these societies in which we sit all day, we drive cars, we don't move too much, and we have devices that we sit on and we eat very well. And that creates a background of obesity and chronic illness. There are some groups, though, within our population that are very, very prone. So if you look at the Indigenous metabolism or other groups like the Pacific Islanders, it is designed for much leaner times. So very, very efficient metabolism, which is great if you're hunter-gathering and you don't see food that often. Very efficient at storing fat, and that's a survival issue. If you then take that same group and put them in the 21st century in a place where you eat 2-3 times a day and you don't move anywhere near as much, then your metabolism is efficient to good fat stores, I suppose, is the summary. They're good at storing fat, which is, again, a beneficial thing going back in time. But unfortunately, that produces chronic illness and in our current environment. It's very hard to turn that around. Of course, diet and exercise is tremendously important, and studies have been done to show that if you go back to hunter-gathering, you can reverse everything. But on a population basis, that's not something that we can do. We can't turn back the clock and any more than you or I will go back to wandering hunter-gathering either. You know, it's not feasible, and we have to recognise that there's a large percentage of the world population who have this genetic predisposition due to their genetic makeup. And so we're really seeing young onset type 2, nasty malignant type 2 diabetes in these groups that is, the reality is it's very hard to prevent it as much as we will try with lifestyle factors, but it does need quite significant aggressive therapy as time goes forward.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Like how in one situation those strengths would keep you alive, and in this other setting that's not your fault, you're just like set up to fail.
And I think you said the magic word, it's not your fault. And it's a really important message because, you know, if there was a worldwide famine, you know, we'd die off pretty quickly, and this group would live on and on because they're designed. So there is difference in metabolism that people really need to understand when they a lot of people point the finger and say, well, just eat less. It's very easy, very simple. But it doesn't work that way. It's not that simple. And there are really, really strong differences in metabolic makeup of people.
Are you able to talk at all to what the trial is?
Like yes. So
interventions.
Definitely. So, you know, we're looking at a more intensive model of care, which involves weekly visits to clinics rather than just as needed visits to administer weekly injectable agents like these new Ozempic-like drugs. And there's potentially new drugs that we may use in this study, but the idea being that half the communities will be randomised into usual care and half the communities will be randomised into intensive care. And we think in these remote settings, and the reason we, the remote settings are under-resourced and they need more staffing for this. So we're making an argument for more intensive therapy that we're going to cost and make sure that the resources are adequate for these communities, because we believe it's not managed intensively enough in most of these communities because they can't afford to. They haven't got the staff, they can't afford. But I think there's a really strong case if we want to avoid patients going to kidney dialysis and heart failure and other complications, amputations, that we really need to manage this intensively. It needs to be a focus and needs to be something that the government will supply and have a good reason to supply.
And obviously providing the data to back that up helps.
And that's right. It's about actually saying, here's the evidence now. You need to supply this. So we're going to provide them with a cost and what we call cost effectiveness, cost benefit. Mm. So for each dollar you spend on this, you'll save $100 on dialysis or something like that, you know, so we can provide evidence for that.
What would your hope be for the next 10 years for diabetes care?
I think I'm really, really hopeful that the new agents that we have, particularly for type 2, become much more readily available. There's a whole lot of these coming, and we're doing clinical trial work in our population in Melbourne as well with new agents like Ozempic, which are even more powerful and highly effective for obesity and diabetes. And I think there's no question of their benefits for diabetes, but they're expensive and we need to afford them and we need to make them accessible. And I also have a strong hope that for obesity itself, which again is a chronic illness, it's not a lifestyle choice for most people, that we provide these treatments. It's not for the Kardashians who want to, you know, lose a few kilograms and look better. This is for chronic illness, which has serious consequences. So I'm not suggesting that people do this to fit into the next size, you know, outfit, but it's really a chronic illness treatment which has consequences. If you have obesity, you're at risk of hypertension, you're at risk of diabetes, you're at risk of cancer, you're at risk of heart disease. And these medications really seem to make an impact in these areas and not to mention better quality of life. So to date, we don't have any reimbursement for obesity therapies. And I sincerely hope the government rethinks that, because if you want to get Ozempic for obesity, you've got to pay a lot of money now. And for these newer agents, even more so. But I do think it needs a rethink from the government, who to date haven't valued therapy of obesity, and they see this as a major cost. But I think in the long run, I think it's going to be cost-saving and tremendously important therapies, which are really going to change the world.
Yeah. It involves a little bit of longer-term thinking.
Correct.
Yeah, short-term cost for a long, like you're saving a lot of, to be cold, you're saving a lot of money long-term.
I think that's where health systems don't do well, is long-term thinking. I think they think year on year about the budgets that they have. But, you know, I think you're right. I think this is a long-term challenge for healthcare systems, and it will benefit them enormously. It will reduce outcomes, hospitalisation expenses, all sorts of complications.
How did you end up in your role? Like, what was your path from high school to here?
Wow, okay. So, I mean, I went from high school to medicine, and I guess from there I had to make a decision about, was I going to do surgery? Was I going to do pediatrics or pathology? So you get all these choices, and it's funny how you end up where you are, but I think I really enjoyed, I definitely wasn't going to be a surgeon, that's for sure. I didn't like cutting and sewing. That wasn't my thing. So I'm demeaning surgery. Wasn't my thing at all. But, you know, I liked the hands-on, talking to patients, managing patients, building a relationship with patients. So this field of medicine, first of all, you know, of course, you have to do what's called physician training if you want to do medicine as opposed to surgery. And that's a number of years of work and study. And then you choose a subspecialty of medicine, of which you can do a whole range of things, cardiology, gastroenterology. But I liked endocrinology. It was just my thing. And I thought, again, chronic disease management is really interesting, and getting to know people, getting to help people with unfortunate illnesses.
And ending up at the Baker?
Yeah, so a bit of a journey, but, you know, I think I started out doing a little bit of research, then I did a bit of clinical medicine, and I started doing some clinical work at what was then called the International Diabetes Institute, And then I was there for a number of years and a little bit of research there. And then we had a merger with the institute called the Baker Institute. And so we became a heart and diabetes institution. And so that opened up a lot of opportunities in terms of large clinical service, which I ended up running as well, but in terms of research opportunities as well, and dealing and having interactions with cardiology colleagues as well. So I think we now have a really interesting group here. It's clinical medicine, but Baker also has basic scientists where people do animal work and test tube type work as well. So it's a really nice range of research that we do here, which I think is fascinating.
And having spoken to a couple of the other researchers, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice that you would give young Neil?
Wow.
Career.
Yes. No, not personal advice. Look, career-wise, I've had a really enjoyable career. I think, you know, I would say do the research, particularly research. I think clinical medicine, we all find a pathway to do clinical work, and I really enjoy my clinical work. But I think in terms of research, I would give advice to myself and others to do the research that isn't going to necessarily win you lots of awards or lots of papers, but do the research that you believe makes a difference to people. And I think that if you do that, I think it's much more enjoyable. I mean, you know, you can do other types of research that will get you lots of papers and lots of metrics, if you like, but I certainly prefer... I find it really rewarding to do the research that I think, you know, what's going to make the most difference to this group of people. But you have to do clinical work at the same time because you have to be in touch with the people and know what is needed and what is required. So it's a difficult mix to do because it means you're busy with your clinical work and you're busy with your research and you need to do both. But if it's enjoyable, I think none of us mind turning up to an enjoyable hard days of work. And I think that's probably the main message.
I think that's really nice. It's not just about the papers.
Yes.
I feel like you've touched on a couple of myths, but is there any other specific myths, maybe particularly in diabetes, that you would like to take this opportunity to bust?
Yeah, look, I think the shame and blame is something that I have a real issue with. Particularly not so much type 1, I think people understand type 1, but hopefully. But the type 2 shame and blame, you know, we can avoid. There's a lot of media hype about preventing diabetes, and you can to some degree prevent diabetes by lifestyle measures. But there's, in many people who try very, very hard, it's a very difficult thing to manage, and to just be told that you're simply eating too much or you need to lose some weight. It's very, very hard to lose weight. The body is designed to not let you lose weight. You know, going back hundreds of thousands of years, if you lost 10 kilograms, your body would say, hang on, that's dangerous. We've got to stop that. And so it changes your metabolism, changes your metabolic rate, makes you hungrier, all sorts of things. So losing large amounts of weight is really difficult, nearly impossible. And so some of us can do it. Some of us can really work hard and do that. But in many people that I see, they try extremely hard and they really, their body doesn't allow them to do it. A lot of genetics involved. So I would say people are very judgmental about obesity and type 2 diabetes in a way that I'm very uncomfortable with. And for the most part, I think it really does hurt people to be judged in that way. And some people need a lot more therapy than others. And it's a chronic illness. It's like many chronic illnesses, it's largely not people's fault any more than cancer is people's fault. There's obviously lifestyle factors in cancer, but we don't sit and judge people with cancer and say, well, it's all your fault. So I really think the shame and blame is something I hope we can move forward with. I think we've done a great job with things like depression and mental health, but this is now our next frontier where I really hope we can say, look, you're really unlucky and unfortunate and we want to help you.
And without that, there's going to be a whole lot of people who avoid going to the doctor.
Exactly right. That's exactly right.
Fingers crossed. And, you know, keep up the good work, obviously.
Yeah.
Is there anything else we haven't touched on that you'd like to share?
Ooh, What else can I tell you about? Yeah, I think we've covered most of these things. No, I think I'll get off my soapbox. So most of it we've covered pretty thoroughly. And, you know, again, I just want to reiterate the issues about chronic illness and genetics and judgment. I really think it's time people do understand and turn off social media a little bit, where there's a lot of noise about all sorts of curative potions and diets that don't work. And, you know, I think it's really important that we get properly educated about diabetes and obesity. It's not as simple as people think. It's not just a matter of just heal yourself. It's not that simple. And it's a serious metabolic challenge for many, many people.
I'm part of a very complex ecosystem.
That's right. I mean, we've produced this world that is, and there's not really any turning back easily for most people. From the day-to-day lives, we walk much, much less than we did 50 years ago. We eat probably more, and we do a lot of sitting around, and it's very hard to stop that.
I think it's a very hard world to be healthy in.
Correct.
Like, exactly. It's much easier to be unhealthy, really.
Well, it's designed for, you know, minimal movement, because we want to be so efficient that we can't walk to work, and we can't necessarily move that much. We want to drive everywhere. We sit at computers because it's easier. So it's much more efficient to not move much.
Yeah, sort of short term, until you spend all the time waiting at the doctor's.
Correct. That's right.
Yeah. So to wrap up, are you able to give us a shout out, a high five virtual for someone or someone who you think is doing an awesome job and just deserves a virtual shout out?
Oh, someone who's doing an awesome job? You mean at our institution?
Anywhere in the world.
Anywhere in the world. Wow. Gee, that's a left of center. Look, I think some of the people involved in type 1 management, and there's a whole lot of organizations like Insulin for Life that make sure insulin goes to the right places. Again, just recognizing this is a life-threatening illness for people, and people will die in various areas of conflict, etc., who don't have access to the right medication. So I think that's really, they're the champions. I think they do tremendous work. You know, I think they're a really important group, but there's many, many great groups around the world doing tremendous work with type 1 and even type 2 and obesity. So I don't think I could be more specific than that. But lots of. I think the other thing I would just say about Australia is that we do terrific research in this country, but I think we undervalue it as a country. And I'd like to see government support research and development here a lot more, and so that we can do even better work in this space.
And just seeing how far, like particularly the tech stuff, is coming and how quickly.
Very much so. Very much so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Improvements are. Yeah. Cool. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Dr. Neil. It has been absolutely delightful, and good luck with all the research. It sounds very hopeful.
Thanks very much. Thanks for chatting.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like this episode, please pass it on to someone else who you think might enjoy it as well. And if you want to support Avid Research this year, that would be amazing. You can buy us a coffee, head to avidresearch.com.au, and there'll be a link, buy me a coffee, and you can support us with a one-off little coffee payment. Thanks so much for listening. You're a legend.